Broadcasted live. Catch the broadcast on kaya959.co.za.
All right, so I want us to talk about something that we've been discussing over months, actually, on this show, but we were forced to halt this conversation because we were dealing with the election. So we're now in our cooling off period, and we wanted to go back to some of the things that matter to us, international relations. We've been talking a lot about what's happening in Gaza. And the very latest now, as you may know, is that the International Court of Justice on Friday the 24th ordered Israel to immediately halt its military offensive in Gaza. But we all know that not much has changed, unfortunately. Zain Dango is a Director General in Durco. Thanks so much for agreeing to see us today. Good evening and welcome.
Good evening and thanks for having me.
I suppose we weren't surprised by what Israel did subsequent to ICJ's ruling.
No, we're not surprised. And that's the tragedy of it, is that part of the reason why Israel can do what it's doing in Gaza, but also the whole of Palestine, is that there's been an institutionalized impunity, whereas Israel has almost been seen as the exception to complying with international law. You know, so prior to being taken to the ICJ on a contentious matter, they've been to the ICJ for what is called advisory opinions, and even those advisory opinions they've ignored. Over 5 decades of ignoring Security Council resolutions, which are generally binding to all, but not binding to Israel. The provisional orders from the very first set of provisional orders were binding, the ones, you know, the court first passed in January. And the latest one, where there's a more explicit call for a ceasefire.
Absolutely.
And the reason why we ask for a more explicit call is we've seen Israel and some of its supporters seeking to interpret what the judges were saying as a way to explain that they can continue doing what they're doing. And now it's a flagrant, flagrantly just ignoring a call for a ceasefire, but not just ignoring it, intensifying the action. And it's almost like the proverbial, you know, finger to the world that says, we don't care, nobody's going to stop us, no force can stop us, no law can stop us. And they're doing that because they know they can get away with it. They've been allowed to get away with it for many, many years. Any other country that would have broken that many international laws would have been subjected to countermeasures such as arms embargoes for other forms of boycotts. And none of that has happened.
And of course, part of what makes this possible is the support by the U.S., as we know, is quite behind Israel. And even as they tweak their language, it's a couple of steps forward and a couple of steps back. I mean, we've heard what Biden said recently, again, vehemently, quite on the side of Israel, saying that they, you know, this is not a genocide, quite emphatically saying that, which I thought was quite bizarre that he had to go there. So one wonders, how do you think this will affect the U.S. elections?
Look, it is a factor in the U.S. elections. You can see by the number of protests in the U.S. And it's not a question of choosing between the two candidates as being better on the Israeli issue. I think what you're finding is many young people saying they'll rather stay away from the votes in the absence of
accountability,
which can only you know, be bad for President Biden. So it is an election issue. But the bigger issue, though, is that when the U.S. does this, and big powers tend to do that, all the big powers, tend to see themselves as being outside of accountability mechanisms. For the ICC, for example, the big powers are not state parties to the ICC, including Israel. And the reason for that is they see the use of force in war as a legitimate diplomatic tool and want to do that in an unfettered manner without being held accountable by others in the international community. But at the same time, they do stand on a pedestal and say, we respect international law, we want the international rules-based order, but only if we can be in charge of it. What South Africa has done with the ICJ and the ICC, together with others, of course, is almost, to use a term South Africans often don't like, is decolonize these colonial institutions to make it work for countries in the South. To begin to argue that these kinds of institutions may have these kind of colonial architectural history, but they can be used for middle powers and smaller powers who don't have big armies, who don't have large economies to try and sway global opinion, but we can use the institutions of global governance in the way that it was meant to. But with the U.S. undermining it, we'll find it, you know, the danger is it gives a sense to others that they too can act with impunity.
Absolutely.
And you will have the proverbial Wild West in international
relations.
And then
the question is, what's the point?
Yeah.
With this ruling, and we know the U.S. is not going to stop giving the U.S. Israel arms, for those, because it's not just the U.S., for those who continue to give Israel arms with this particular ruling, do you think we can then find a way to hold them accountable?
Yes, I think the laws are going to be applicable to them as well.
Yes.
So the Genocide Convention makes very specific reference to aiding and abetting. And aiding and abetting genocide is a crime as well, and they can be charged as well, especially now that there's a clear binding order that says stop the genocidal actions, including stop the military operations. And, you know, so what we saw last night was particularly horrible in Rafah. And what they were using was the 2,000-ton bombs supplied to them by the U.S. You know, so 2,000-ton bombs on tents is like nuclear bombs in the city. There's no other means of mitigating the harm that's associated with that. You know, so there's already, you know, there's in international law jurisprudence from Nuremberg days. Private companies have been held liable for supplying the Nazis with, you know, with, for example, the gas that we used in the chambers. German companies that manufactured arms were held liable, criminally liable, individuals as well. And we now have an apex court dealing with criminal liability, which is the ICC. And even though they are not state parties, they can still be held liable. And we see now with the two charges against the two senior Israeli politicians.
Yes.
If the ICC does its investigations properly, you may find others being hauled before the court as well.
So that warrant of arrest that was issued, do you think it will mean anything? And I know, of course, Hamas is also some of its members are also charged as well. But do you think they will effect it?
Look, the fact that the prosecutor has asked the pretrial chamber to issue the warrant of arrest is important. Mm-hmm. It's highly unlikely that the pretrial ranger will not issue those warrants.
Okay.
If it does, it will be an indictment on the ICC. The evidence base is high. It's not just the evidence base that South Africa presented in terms of the ICJ. There's an evidence base that the prosecuting team have looked at themselves. The recommendations for the charges came from a panel of jurists. The Navi Pillay, which is a former South African judge, had a commission of inquiry. There's evidence from that. There's evidence from the special rapporteur on the occupied territories. She presented a report to the Human Rights Commission called Anatomy of a Genocide. There's evidence from eight other special rapporteurs calling this a genocide. So the ICC did not choose to level the crime of genocide, and we will engage with them on that. But the war crimes and other crimes are important. The impact of this, though, the impact is that at the very least, it'll be a travel ban for President Netanyahu to 122 countries.
But to your point, I mean, the evidence itself is quite solid in the sense that South Africa relied also quite heavily on UN agencies themselves, which means that, you know, we are not really biased on this. But Israel seems to think it doesn't matter. Israel seems to think that they can counter that evidence with their own evidence, which nobody can verify.
So they're not actually countering it with evidence. They're countering it with bluster. So and deflection. You know, the UN agencies have produced credible evidence. The special rapporteurs, Francisca Albanese, they do meticulous work, working with universities, expert researchers. So the evidence base is strong. For example, in genocide, you know, genocide turns on intent. Intent is almost the most difficult issue to prove in any genocide because you can kill 20 people.
Yeah.
And if it's intent, it's genocide. You can kill 20,000 people without intent and it's not genocide. Mm-hmm. But in this case, the issue of intent is front and center.
Mm.
And it's been front and center since at least 2014. In genocidal intent, systemic programs that seek to depopulate large parts of the Palestinian territories all form part of the crime of genocide. It's one of the most, it's one of the easiest cases to prove from an intent perspective. And the ICC prosecutors have this in front of them as well.
I'm wondering what all of this means for Netanyahu in Israel. Because we've seen now some sort of momentum, and that's almost new, I think, where there is, I suppose, people seeing this as his agenda as opposed to seeking to find the hostages. And it's starting to gain momentum, and I'm not sure how strong that momentum is, because you can also see the prejudice. They themselves as a society still are pretty much against Palestinians, but there is still this pushback about the agenda of this invasion.
Yes, I think there is unhappiness in large parts of the Israeli society about what the way the Israeli government is engaging militarily. You know, I think it's dawning on many people that the hostages that Hamas taken is not really the issue. Because if it was the issue, then the peace deal in December that was on offer would have been taken. The peace deal that was on offer a month ago would have been taken. But we see these statements coming from senior Israeli officials as saying, nothing is going to make us stop waging a war, not even the peace deal. So it, you know, it goes back to the initial intent. The initial intent was we need a what is called by, for example, the finance minister Smotrich, the final war. And the final war is about ensuring that we find ways of ensuring we get rid of people, Palestinian people from Gaza, whether it's through fear, through mass deaths, or, you know, ethnic cleansing. And this is dawning on many people. You know, when South Africa first pointed out that systemic genocide is in play, Israeli historians like Ilan Pape, for example, 2 decades ago started writing about incremental genocide being at play. And but we're now seeing it, you know, the pace is there and it's in front of our eyes. It's on people's cell phones when they had access to communications. We had Al Jazeera and other journalists. And the reason why journalists have been killed and kept out of the space is to ensure that it's kept out of the eyes of the global community.
That we're starting to see some European countries now stating that they recognize Palestine as a state, do you think that will move the needle a bit?
I do think it will move the needle a bit. The vast majority of the world's countries do recognize the state of Palestine, even in its current form. You know, the original resolution 181 in 1948, as flawed as it was, did make provision for 2 states. But in the end, only the colonial component of the state got statehood, and the colonized did not get statehood. And the colonized were blamed for not getting statehood because they refused to accept, for example, that people could not return. You know, the ethnic cleansing agenda was then already, because the idea of the demographic majority issue was always high on the agenda. But it is going to make a difference. The fact that Norway, Ireland, and Spain has now clearly stated what many other European countries have wanted to do for a while, but maybe found that they wanted to see whether they could get a unified European response. But what this is showing is that the differences within Europe on this is now emerging. The manner in which Israel is acted and behaved in disregard for international law may see more countries doing the same over the next couple of months.
It's one thing to discuss what Europe and the West is doing, but it's quite an elephant in the room is that a lot of the African countries were not singing and from the same hymn book, even when South Africa went to the ICJ. Is that concerning? And I mean, even at that level, at ICJ, you could see that the descending judgment and vote is from an African judge, which is uncomfortable maybe.
Yeah. So I think the judge is there basically on a essentially an African judge, but hasn't really lived in Uganda for much of her life.
Fair enough.
And the Ugandan,
I suppose it's the same as the U.S. ambassador to the U.N. being black, and it's quite an uncomfortable sight.
After the first judgment, you saw the Ugandan government distance themselves from her.
Yes, I did.
Yeah. But the issue about African countries is we fully understand where the challenges many of them face. I mean, the kind of challenges we were under and pressure that we are under with the Congress trying to put South Africa into some kind of axis of evil approach, and specifically about this issue and levy sanctions on us. When we meet other African countries, they will tell us, thank you for doing what you've done. We can't do it. Mm. And we understand that. And, you know, the kind of support the president and the minister got at the AU after the ICJ case, and even the ICC issue, was enormous. Yeah, and the AU expressed support for what South Africa is doing. But we fully understand the challenges. There's economic and diplomatic bullying is the reality.
I was going to say, the bullying, we're getting low-key bullying here ourselves. Yeah. I mean, the UK issued a statement not so long ago warning its terrorists in South Africa that there may be a terror attack, they must look out, that which, as you guys said, was unfounded. Yeah. You know, even in any way, even the procedure was not followed in how you would actually reach that kind of that position and statement. That is low-key bullying, I would say. Mm. It's not the first time we've seen it with the U.S. too.
Yeah, so that kind of, and that is sort of the minor component of it, right? And that is the kind of bullying that you can easily explain away and say, you know, the U.K. is repeating an old advisory that they did when the U.S. gave its advisory on Santen.
Yes.
and they just sort of didn't delete it from
rehashed
the website.
It, yep.
Yeah. The real issue is the kind of pressure that you find on and what we call the Hill, where the Congress people would write letters about South Africa, you know, or seek to have these kind of bills put in place, the economic sanctions, which they have not succeeded to do. And that's because we went and we explained and we campaigned and we worked with U.S. Civil society and senators, you know, the Black Caucus and others, and we explained these kind of issues. And fighting back is something that many other African countries just don't have the resources to do. We can engage diplomatically. I can tell you that many senior diplomats from Europe and the U.S. also tell me, thank you for doing what we can't say.
Well, thank you so much for staying with us. Zain Danko is with me. He is a Director General at DIRCO, and we are really talking about all things international relations. You're very welcome to take the time to call in. You can send an X. You can also send a voice note. Here's a question from Wendy Isaacs. It says, what is the political strategy for continued calls for a two-state solution? Is it still viable in your view? Yes.
Thank you, Wendy. Look, the two-state solution is the legal framework that was used since Oslo. So it's the international framework that, for example, as government we will use because we engage with other governments on this. But the reality is that the two-state solution has been imperiled substantively because, for example, the current Prime Minister Netanyahu was always against Oslo, always felt that there'll only be one state and a bit of a Bantustan. So it will be one state, two systems, which is essentially apartheid, which is emerging now. Our view is that we should be calling for a system where the human rights of all.
That's a subsequent question. Yeah. She says, your thoughts on the one democratic state for all?
So I think the one democratic state for all is one that is gaining currency, both in civil society in Palestine and across the world. And some governments are beginning to engage with it.
Yeah.
We will have to engage with it as well as a policy issue, given the fact that the manner in which the illegal settlements has taken place will make the architecture of a two-state solution quite difficult. But what we feel is that it should be, if you premise it on the human rights for all who are legally entitled to live there, including those who are currently in exile, the right of return, that we should leave to Palestinians and Israelis to discuss and negotiate, of course facilitated by the outside world. So we're not going to take a dogmatic approach on either one of these issues. Mm. I think the principles of self-determination, self-determination emerging from a process of decolonization, which is important in this context, but we will err on the side of getting to talk so that a lasting solution premised on human rights is found, and whether that's a one-state solution where human rights predominate or a two-state solution that is genuine in terms of land and not an apartheid issue is one that I think some will be putting on the table as well. So I do think that's a discussion. I think the majority of Palestinians I speak to today talk about a one-state solution that is premised on human rights. But there are still others who talk about a two-state solution. So, you know, we will listen to what they want, but and help them to engage on what will be best for all who are entitled to live there.
Realistically, with all our South Africa's efforts, I mean, where do you see this ending? How do we see this ending?
Look, the pressure that Israel is going to be put under. I mean, if I put myself in, if you look at South Africa in the late 1980s, the South African government was going through the same.
Yeah.
The apartheid government was going through the same pressures. And I think that what is called the South Africa moment is emerging for Palestine now. Mm. And it's about how do you take that and run with it from a negotiating perspective. But what we did not have to contend with, and I was a young activist then, was genocidal action. We don't know how this kind of genocidal action is going to determine the outcome of a lasting solution. What is needed right now is for a ceasefire. What is needed right now is for the countermeasures to be put in place to actually hold the Israeli government accountable. And that kind of accountability will perhaps lay the basis for them genuinely coming to the table to talk. But in the absence of genuine countermeasures by the international community, we could see a continuation of seeking to depopulate not only Gaza but also other parts of the occupied territories going forward. You can see already some of them talking about renaming what is now called the West Bank, Judea and Samaria. Mm. And that is again another indication of we own all of this. All of this is ours. And as many Palestinians must leave. If I may, one of the gains that this ICJ case has had is it's for the very first time gotten people speaking on behalf of the Israeli government, for example, the legal team talking about Palestinian people. Mm. Israeli politicians and governments never talk about Palestinian people. They'll talk about Arabs.
Mm.
Because talking about Palestinian people will acknowledge that there was a Palestine, and that Palestinian people exist as an identifiable unit and therefore have a claim to self-determination.
Mm.
They used the term Palestinian people for the first time. The second thing they did was to talk about internationally recognized borders. They've never ever spoken about internationally recognized borders before, because now we can ask them, what is those recognized borders? Is it 67? Is it 48?
Mm-hmm.
Because it also provides the kind of parameters around which we can negotiate around. So I think there's some pluses that inadvertently emerge from this that we can use in the international arena. As far as we are concerned, for us it's to stop the carnage.
Of course.
Immediately. Mm. Stopping the carnage is front and center what we want to achieve right now. And then we can work with others towards a just and lasting solution.
Mm. What do you think the Iranian President Raisi's death is going to mean for this region? Especially right now.
Look, I think both the president and also the foreign minister were both in the helicopter. Mm. By all indications, it was an accident. If it was not an accident, then I would say there'll be turmoil in the region, right? Because the Iranians will not take kindly to any attack of that nature.
That would be.
I think they've responded rather mildly to the attacks on the embassies. Mm-hmm. But I do think that under the current circumstances, and just talking to our ambassador, there is accepting it as an accident in the absence of evidence, and they will regroup. There'll be an election for a new prime minister quite soon. but I don't think it's going to have any major impact on the region. The kind of deal brokered, which was very important between Saudi Arabia and Iran, brokered by China, has changed the mood in the region. Mm. We always said that is, you know, when Saudi Arabia and Iran make peace, then the rest of the region will actually come together. Mm. And I think that's a major threat. The fact that it is almost the two polar contending powers in the region, which is Saudi Arabia and Iran, coming together is a threat to those who want to see, who seek to destabilize the region constantly by playing up these two against each other and finding proxies to support either one or the other. Mm. I think that we will continue to work with China and others to build peace and understanding amongst the countries in that region.
Egypt is walking a very tightrope, though.
Look, I think Egypt, most of the frontline states are, right? Frontline states to Palestine. And Egypt is always been at the center of it. Mm-hmm. So I remember the 67 war was essentially Egypt. Mm-hmm. And there's a peace treaty between Egypt and Israel as a result of that. Mm. I just got a WhatsApp where I'm sitting here by one of the lawyer that I know, not our legal team people. Mm-hmm. In London, saying that there's reports of Israeli soldiers firing across the border onto Egyptians.
Oh, wow.
And I hope that's not true, because means that it pulls the Egyptians into this thing in a military manner. I think Egypt and Qatar has been playing a really good role in terms of trying to find a way of negotiating peace deals. Qatar has basically said with the attacks on Rafah today is going to make their participation difficult. Egypt is already indicating that they may pull out. But we understand that, you know, the streets in Egypt, the streets in Qatar, the streets in Saudi Arabia have voiced their support, and they voiced what they will support and what they won't support. And I think their governments are quite responsive to that.
It's tough, though, with Egypt. Mm. I mean, diplomatically, I'm not sure they can afford to financially, too. It's a tough one.
Yeah. I think they are in a tight spot. Yeah. But I do think they're working very closely with us and others around finding solutions. You know, Egypt has joined the case now.
Yes, I did see that, yeah.
And that's a major step. A major step to have a large African country, which is also a large part of the Arab group and of the OIC, taking that stance is a major, major step, which shows
funded
that
a lot by the U.S.
Yeah.
And it
shows you a sea shift in how Egypt is looking at this and how they're willing to collaborate with many of us in terms of ensuring that the safety of Palestinians are secured.
If we move a little bit to the continent now, there are many challenges in the continent. Terrorism, conflict, interstate conflict and intrastate conflict, which are unfortunately, a threat to democracy of some sorts. Mm. But we've got 19 elections.
Yeah.
In the continent, in this year alone, explain how you feel about that, because as I said, you know, there are a lot of those other things, but we've got 19 elections in this year.
So the last 5 years we can talk as a period of sort of democratic backsliding.
Mm-hmm.
But before that, I think you saw democratic consolidation of the continent, right? So you saw elections taking place. Mm. Some of them people may have questioned and fair, but we're working towards that systems. We saw a reduction of, a significant reduction in what we call unconstitutional changes of government.
Yes.
Both because the way that the AU was engaging with this, but also because there was really the African Renaissance issue that, you know, President Mbeki and his peers were working on. And it really worked to galvanize an African spirit and around democracy and development. What we're seeing now over the last few years is some of those cleavages returning, you know, and it's a lot of it is to do with the resources that Africa has.
Mm.
Let's take the DRC, for example. Mm-hmm. We always say that unless we fix the DRC, Africa is not going to be fixed.
That's correct,
just given the size of the DRC, the wealth in
the
DRC. Almost every critical mineral one can think of can be found in the DRC. Mm. And what is often depicted as ethnic clashes is really, engineered clashes
resources.
Around control over resources. Mm-hmm. It's about these resources are fungible.
Mm-hmm.
And whoever controls that fungibility and ensures that the pattern of extraction continues to benefit previous colonial states, they'll be in power. And as soon as they do not toe the line, then you have coups.
Yeah, absolutely.
So part of what we must do is find ways of ensuring that we use these minerals and wealth for local development. And that's a discussion that's emerging now on the continent. A critical mineral strategy that works for Africa, and an AU strategy is one that we're working with others on this. The inter-African trade is going to be critical.
Yes.
But also the peer reviews must continue. The kind of pressures that we need to put on each other around good governance, democratization, and countermeasures when you have unconstitutional changes of government must take place.
Mm.
We mustn't confuse unconstitutional governments purely because it comes across as an anti-colonial sentiment. It may have elements of that, but if people are suffering and government institutions are degraded in the process, then we're laying the basis for more strife rather than better governance.
Which then lends us to that very uncomfortable situation of aid, foreign aid, which we also know is not... it's also political.
Yeah.
and it's not just aid for the sake of aid. We know this.
So it's a cyclical issue, right? Mm-hmm. So you extract the resources, mm-hmm. which is essentially the wealth that people could use for development. You know, mm-hmm. the right to development is making your own resourceable, fungible for yourselves. Mm-hmm. And if it's extracted by, former colonial states, and what they do is give you back your own wealth, mm-hmm. a percentage of your own wealth through mm-hmm. aid, and tie that to mm-hmm. certain conditionalities, mm-hmm. it leads to a continued underdevelopment. Mm-hmm. So, we need to get to the point where we use the AFCFTA mm-hmm. as a lever for development and inclusive growth and development, but tie that to the genuine discussions of good governance across the continent.
Hi, Pumelo and your guest. Maybe I'm naive or something. I don't understand. My question is, why is it that when anyone criticizes the actions of Israel, generally in what they're doing or in any manner, then it is considered as anti-Semitic? Can you please maybe explain to me so that I can understand this anti-Semitic thing? How does it work? Because each time... even in social media, even in any other platform where anyone can say anything against Israel is considered to be anti-Semitic. What exactly does that mean, really?
Thanks for staying with us, Zain. I'm going to ask you to respond to that. But also, I suppose you've also got the warning as South Africa to not arrest Zionists in the country. So these things do come through.
No, it's an important question because it's a means of silencing criticism. You know, we must from the onset say that anti-Jewish racism and discrimination is something that we will always oppose. And criticizing Israel is not criticizing Jewish people or mm-hmm. the Jewish faith. Criticizing Zionism, which is an ideology. And it's important to note the history of Zionism is actually not even linked to Judaism. Mm-hmm. It's linked to Christianity, a certain form of Christianity that emerged that, had the doomsday scenarios mm-hmm. and had a particular narrative about what needs to happen in Palestine.
Mm-hmm.
What is really fueling anti-Semitism is those who seek to link Judaism to what Israel is doing.
Mm.
And we always say what the state of Israel is doing and its supporters across the world has got nothing to do with Judaism.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, if you speak to South African Jews for Free Palestine, in South Africa, big mm-hmm. growing movement of young mm-hmm. people, Jewish Voice for Peace in the U.S. and in Europe,
mm-hmm.
they will tell you the lessons from Judaism that mm-hmm. mitigates against the kind of racism the kinds of actions we see the Israeli state doing. Mm. Those who fuel anti-Semitism are those who link Judaism with the actions of the state of Israel and who link criticism of the state of Israel to Judaism. And you find a way that anti-Semitism is then weaponized to silence people, to shut down dissent. Mm. But it's become something that most people across the world are now seeing for what it is. Mm. It is a means of silencing genuine criticism. Mm. But I repeat that we will always mitigate against anti-Jewish racism and discrimination, just like we will do with any form of discrimination.
There's a concern I personally have that there are conflicts that span so long that we tend to tire, the world gets fatigued, and there are peoples that get left behind. Western Sahara is one such case where I just don't know where we stand. I know what our policy is, but where the world stands with that issue, because I suppose when their own resistance tires, the world also tires. Your sentiments on that?
So the Western Sahara specifically is, you know, it's again, you know, one of those cases where the ICJ says it's an occupation. So occupation is not an accusation, it's a fact. So we're working with the people of Western Sahara, its representatives in Polisario, but we're also working with the Moroccans to find a solution that is peaceful and lasting and guided by what the UN resolutions are saying, which is a referendum. And not the referendum where, you know, the indigenous people are swamped with numbers coming from
this
outside.
This is it, yeah.
But the strategy that you know, the notion of long wars is one that is deliberate. You know, the longer you prolong war, fatigue sets in.
Yep.
People forget that this is something that needs to be dealt with. And then it becomes peace at any cost. You know, the more violent people become, peace at any cost then also becomes a significant issue. So, you know, while we believe that wars are always foolish, you know, irrespective of whether it is lawful or unlawful, we believe that it's foolish, because dealing with the aftermath of war becomes the imperative rather than building peace or building solutions. So Western Sahara is one of those examples where it's protracted, and it's protracted by design. But I do think that we must give it you know, the kind of impetus over the next 2 or 3 years that will perhaps see some kind of breakthrough. You know, we've been working with the UN-appointed, you know, representative to find solutions, and I think the discussions with Algeria, with Morocco, with Polisario, with the U.S. and others may yield some kind of breakthrough over the next couple of years.
How worried are you about Sudan at the moment?
Exceptionally worried about Sudan. You know, our team is doing a detailed analysis of what is happening there. We've been trying to work with others to try and broker peace between the standing army and the RSF, which is the rebel grouping. But the specter of genocide is there.
That's it. That's the reason I ask, and that you are starting to hear those murmurs
the
around
specter
it
of genocide
being genocide. We're
going to have to deal with that, and that's what we're asking our team to just provide us with the evidence base for. We cannot afford Sudan to go into the kind of turmoil that it currently is. You know, we're seeing 1 million people, you know, currently displaced, which is significant. The AU, we're having discussions with the AU. We're having what we call, you know, we're having NGOs and experts in diplomacy and mediation work with us on means to find solutions. But in the end, I think we may even have to look at what are the instruments of global justice that can be deployed there in a way that deals with accountability. And this is the conundrum one is always faced with, is peace without justice, peace with justice, And where does it intersect?
I'm starting to think a lot about the role of the media. We call it here the fourth estate. And how partly why we can't even wrap our heads around a genocide in Sudan is because we're not seeing it, which is quite different to what we're seeing in Gaza. And thank goodness we had an Al Jazeera. But just the role of the media and why Africa does not just get its act together in at least supporting its own media, because, you know, the BBCs and all those international, they don't see them as credible in those countries, in some of the African countries. They don't want Western media. They're not going to allow it. They're not going to entertain them in those spaces. We've seen that anyway. They've been asked to leave. But the role of African lenses in the continent to tell its own story, because if we don't, we wake up and it's too late.
Yeah. So I think the absence of just the kind of visuals that you have,
that's it.
Right? Is incredible. The part of it is also because people have fled. You know, we have had to evacuate South Africans and also evacuate other nationals that we could assist, including media people from other parts of the world. But we do need the kind of media presence in African spaces that can tell
our story.
With a kind of objectivity. This is what is happening. So that we can actually engage with the facts and find solutions. Because now we're having to look at, you know, what are NGOs telling us. And a lot of it is credible that's emerging at the moment. But we do need the kind of media presence there. And it's something that I think within the fourth estate that needs to be looked at. And if there's anything that we should be doing at the level of the AU to enable that, it'll be useful to engage with the media fraternity.
It would be, because there's a big difference between a media statement released by an AU, for instance, or another government, as opposed to being able to see. And I have a feeling why you have the world and young people really rallying behind the Palestinian cause is because they can see it. No one has to translate it for them. You know, we are engaging with it. And of course, it's terrible to see. But you get a sense, true sense of what the lived experience of the Palestinian is, and that makes a huge difference.
The interesting thing about what's happening on many campuses abroad, but also particularly in South Africa, is the intersection that the anti-genocide protest against Palestine is taking with Sudan. So you're seeing that people are talking about Palestine and Sudan,
which is
DRC.
Yes,
and I think it's important that this is embraced, because, you know, these kinds of levels of impunity is one that we must look at in all spheres and find ways of dealing with them. And just telling the story is one that I think that is the issue that you're raising. And the fact is, you don't get the kind of visuals, the kind of depth and reporting and analysis that you're getting from, you know, what we used to be able to get from Gaza, not so much anymore, now that AP is also being kicked out. But, you know, if we can find ways of just building the footprint of African media, both broadcast, print, I think it will make a difference to the issues of governance that I was speaking about earlier on.
One last thing. I mean, we've been speaking about resources for decades in the continent, centuries actually. That's been one of the things that keeps Africa a talking point. But the issue of climate change and its effect on the continent, even though we're not the biggest emitters, we are certainly feeling what climate change, its effect is having on some of our countries. And that's going to be a diplomatic issue, is it not?
It's going to be a diplomatic issue, because we're going to see conflicts because of climate change. You're going to see forced migration because of climate change. That will give rise to conflicts around resources because the means to make sustainable livelihoods is going to diminish. Soil degradation, degradation of the environment to the extent where food security is going to be a challenge, water is going to be a challenge.
SADC right now is going through a drought.
Yeah,
and we best understand that as South Africa, even though we have rains.
And time frames have been compressed. So what the international the IPC, the International Panel of Scientists, was saying it will happen in 20 years' time. It's now 10 years.
Yeah.
That 2 degrees is no longer, it's now with us.
Mm.
We now have to deploy the mitigation strategies, adaptation strategies that we thought we may have had time to deal with.
Mm.
So we need to take climate change seriously. And we need to, so we're engaging in the G20 at the UN to ensure that the impact of climate change on Africa is taken seriously by the emitters, the historical emitters, and that they must come to the party as agreed to in the Paris agreements, in all the agreements around finding ways to ensure that we do a transition, but the transition is just. The transition takes into cognizance the lived realities of Africans and how they're making a living, the resource base, which is still, you know, fossil fuel based. But how do we move from fossil fuels to green is going to be something that we need to manage quite carefully. And there's agreements on that, which is just not being kept to.
How do you reflect on this administration's term in international relations?
I think that it's been one that has recalibrated where South Africa is. You know,
internationally, yeah.
Internationally, I, you know, the kind of comments we get is, you know, we're back where we should have been.
Now.
You know, we've if you look at just the kind of agreements we broke in Ethiopia, the work that's being done on Palestine. The continued role we're playing in Russia and Ukraine. I'll be going to the peace summit in Switzerland in a couple of weeks' time. But the president has instructed myself, the national security advisor, and his legal advisor to be at every single meeting where these peace talks are taking place. And we're shaping the agenda quite significantly. You know, we broke an agreement at the G20 on these matters that is based on the UN Charter. They respected it for Ukraine, but disrespected for Palestine. but it's important that we've been able to do this and lay the basis for the kind of diplomatic work that is rights-based, that's based on principle. You know, we were criticized on Russia, Ukraine, but basically, if you look at principle, we are actually the most consistent country in diplomatic practice on principle. You know, we basically said, well, we may understand Russia's concerns about NATO. Their use of force in Ukraine is unlawful.
Mm-hmm.
And you cannot annex land through the use of force. So these kind of consistencies is what people miss. Yeah?
I was going to ask you that. I just want to quickly ask you on that, that people will hear the one part of our policy and not the other. Why do you think that is?
I think people will hear what they want to hear.
Yes.
You know, when we pointed out to them, the only reason why we may have abstained on resolutions, it's a yes, but.
Mm.
And the but was because there was not a profile on moving towards peace.
Gotcha.
But we helped negotiate and craft the fact that you cannot annex land through the use of force. And South Africa is consistent in that. Mm. We don't recognize Kosovo because it was founded through the use of force. We don't recognize Croatia, the lands that Russia has since 2014 occupied through the use of force. Mm. And we engage fully with them about that because they understand where we come from on principle.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact is that you find that, let's take the principle of you cannot annex land through the use of force, which we agreed to in October in Delhi at the G20. And, no, September. Mm-hmm. In October, many of the countries that agreed to that suddenly did not feel that it was so important in the context of Palestine.
Of course.
So I do think that this administration has played a major role in resetting South Africa's diplomatic stance. We're not perfect, but we've made significant strides in recalibrating what we stood for.
Do you think with the expansion of BRICS, the new world order is going to be realized?
We must look at what BRICS is.
Mm-hmm.
So BRICS is essentially, and especially expanded BRICS, but the original BRICS was really an economic grouping. And it's some political issues, but it's economic grouping. It's not really there to craft a new world order. you know, the same BRICS countries are in the G20. You know, even with BRICS Plus, you have Saudi Arabia, well, they've not fully accepted. But, you know, they're there, we're there, Brazil's there, mm-hmm. India's there, Russia's there, China's mm-hmm. there. So the major players in BRICS are in the G20. Mm-hmm. And we all feel, well, the BRICS countries in particular feel mm-hmm. that the major institution that facilitates interstate dialogue remains the UN, as flawed as it is.
Yeah.
So we don't see a new world order. What we do see is the need to change the rules so that it's not biased towards the few, not mm-hmm. biased towards the powerful, and that, you know, middle powers and developing countries and African countries can use these institutions of global governance to make their voices heard, to create a fairer world. We don't have big armies. We don't have big economies to bully. We need to work within a reformed and transformed, you know, international legal and political framework.
And you've been calling for this even with the Security Council for a long time now, you know. Yeah. Make it accessible.
Yes.
Open it up.
And together with Brazil, they're the chair of the G20 this year, we'll be the chair next year. We'll be making sure that this is number one on the agenda, because we can see just how the weaknesses in the global peace and security architecture has impacted on people's lives. When one country can veto a resolution that costs thousands of lives.
We can see it now.
And we see who the sort of the habitual veto wielders are.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Ntenko, thank you so much for your time.
No, thank
really
you for having me on the show.
Really appreciate it. He's the Director General at DIRCO.
If you missed it live, catch the broadcast on kaya959.co.za.